Welcome to the Blazing Ember podcast, where we aim to amplify the voices of Latino professionals. We, Diana and Maria, founded this podcast to explore unspoken rules and all the ships, leadership, mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship with Latino leaders.
We are here to ignite your path to success with valuable insights. Bienvenidos. Bienvenidos. Today, we're talking with Maria Melendez, former Chief Diversity Officer and retired partner at Sidley Austin LLP. Before she retired, Maria led Sidley's efforts to advance and increase diversity inclusion across the firm's global offices and the legal profession. And before that, she was a partner at Sidley for over 20 years. We also know Maria from her extensive volunteer work and lots of work that she did in the New York City area, which we will discuss during this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today, Maria.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So to just get us started and warm us up, can you share a little bit about your journey and what led you to become a lawyer?
Sure. So very quickly, I was born in Ponce, Puerto Rico, was raised in Brooklyn, New York, and was the first in my family to, you know, high school, college, et cetera, law school. And in college, I was a computer science major. Freshman year, I found myself in the computer lab and quickly realized it was 2 a.m. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. So I immediately the next day went over and changed my major to become a marketing major at the School of Management. And one of the courses that I had to take as part of my degree requirements was a law and policy class. And up until that point, and as this is now my junior year, I had no idea about the legal profession. I did not have any, folks in my family or immediate circle of friends that were lawyers. So the professor took an interest in me and suggested that I consider going to law school. And that was it. You know, I enrolled at Albany Law School. One of the things that I probably be a theme throughout this conversation that we're having today is I didn't know what I didn't know. Yeah. And so, for example, you know, I did very well my first year and I was invited to join the law review. And I remember turning to my then boyfriend and I said, you know, this is going to require a lot of work. I don't even know what this is. Nobody's ever talked to me about law review. What is this? And he says to me, well, you know, they invited you and, you know, it seems to be a pretty cool thing. So why don't you do it? And I was like, okay, I'll do it. And, you know, after the fact, of course, I learned that it's so important. If you have an opportunity to join law review, you should do it.
Right.
Because it is something, it is a credential that enhances your marketability as an attorney coming out of law school.
It also enhances your writing ability and your editing ability, right? Which it's a deep dive into doing that.
Absolutely. So that was second semester of my first year. I get invited. I join that summer and that fall. I'm walking around the halls of the school, and one of my professors takes me aside and says, "Hey, are you applying for summer associate positions?" And I was like, what is that? You know, because at the time I was working at a local law firm, a P&I criminal defense firm, and I was having the time of my life. I was doing great work. I was getting paid $10 an hour, and I thought I had made it, you know. And she's like, no, Maria, you know, you should, if you want to start practicing in New York City, you really need to be a summer associate in a firm in New York. And thankfully, at that time, this was now like almost September, October. And I was able to get an interview with Breed Abbott and Morgan and got that job and became a summer associate there and began my career after graduation at Breed Abbott, before, joining, what is now known as Sidley Austin. The partners that I worked with at Breed Abbott invited me to move with them after my first year. And so I began at, what is now Sidley Austin, in 1993. And as you mentioned, I have been with the firm or was with the firm for almost 29 years.
It's hard to step away, right? When you're there that long.
Oh, yeah. It was a lot of, soul searching throughout my career at the firm, because I thankfully I had, you know, I had opportunities to consider different things and different positions, different roles. But each time I considered those opportunities, I felt that Sidley was the right place for me. And I was doing, you know, work that I loved when I was practicing law and then certainly when I became CDO. So I stayed and finished my career there.
Wonderful. So I've often talked about the stats because the stats are awful, at least at leadership in law firms. And I know you were the first Latina partner at the New York office, and there's not many, right? So we can talk about how low that is. Can you give us like a snapshot of some of the unique challenges that you think you faced because you were a Latina at a firm like Sidley Austin or any firm, right? Just kind of what are some of the things you see as challenges that Latinas in those roles would face?
So you're right that I was, Sidley, the firm that's now known as Sidley, merged with Brown and Wood in 2001. And I actually, when I mentioned earlier, I transitioned from what was then Breed, Abbott & Morgan to what is now Sidley. The firm was actually Brown and Wood at the time. And the firm was located at One World Trade Center. And in 2001, in May of 2001, it merged with Sidley and Austin, which was also a global firm based in Chicago. And so that year, my partnership, my lap year was 2001. So I actually came back from maternity leave in June, I think, of 2001. And the decision for new partners was in December of 2001. And I was the first Latina partner from the Brown and Wood side of the firm because the firm was electing partners from the legacy Brown and Wood side of the firm and then partners from the legacy Sidley and Austin side of the firm. Mm-hmm. And I was the first Latina associate to be promoted to partner for the entire Brown and Wood firm. And Brown and Wood was also a global firm. Mm-hmm. My dear, dear friend, Catherine Barrett Valerio was the first Latina associate to be promoted for partner on the Sidley and Austin side. Mm-hmm. So the two of us made it the same year, 2001. And, you know, I would say that I don't think I experienced challenges that were different necessarily from what any associate has to go through to be considered for partner, right? You have to be at the top of your game. Mm-hmm. You have to have the potential to develop a book of business, right? You have to have the ability to excel in your practice area, right? That's, everybody has to do that. I think that what I would say is a challenge for people that are different from the majority, I think the challenge is being visible, right? I think that if you're not someone that is typically represented among partnership ranks, for example, they may not see you, right? And I think that is, and of course, you know, presume for a moment that you're dealing with people who are, you know, honest and good intentioned people, right? There may be people who have different agendas when it comes to gender and other diversity. But assuming that you're dealing with a good place, a good workplace, and certainly I would say that is Sidley, the biggest challenge I think for women and for people of diverse backgrounds generally tends to be, you know, not being visible. And we can talk later about what that is and what, you know, how do you become more visible? Right. But I think that's the challenge.
And sometimes some of us shy away from being visible, right?
But we'll talk. Yeah, and that's it. And that's it. And part of it is culturally, right? Part of it is for many of us Latinas, you know, I can say this for myself. And I, you know, you walk into the workplace, you put your head down and you're just like, oh my God. I, for many, many years, and this is, I mentioned that I was born in Puerto Rico and raised in Brooklyn, single mom, all that. I remember vividly as a first and second year associate sitting at the firm and I look around, right? And there are not many, and I don't remember any Latinas my first year at Breed, Abbott & Morgan. They could have been, I just don't remember any or any diversity to speak of. And I remember, you know, being in my office and I would literally like, okay, one of these days, the senior partner is going to come knock on my door and say, what the hell is this? Boricua sitting here.
She's amazing.
How did you get through the door, right? And I also did not go to, you know, a T12, T14 school, right? I went to, you know, what some would call second tier school. So I really did have some, you know, talking about imposter syndrome. I would sit there and think, you know, wait, one of these days someone's going to wake up and say, you know, how did Maria get in here? But, you know, that's just part of sometimes when you're first generation, some of the fears and worries that we bring with us to our workplace that in hindsight, you know, nobody cares. Nobody cares.
Right. You triggered a memory for me. One of the things that I culturally was kind of raised not to do is ask questions.
Yes. Right?
Because if you ask questions, you're, you know, the word that's used is metida, like you're just kind of getting into people's business as opposed to actually learning, right? It's couched in a negative way. And it always struck me, especially from like my encounters with even just my husband, he asks a ton of questions. And I just was like, why do you ask so many questions still to this day? And he's like, well, how else am I going to know things? And I was like, I don't know, but that's a lot of questions.
Osmosis. You're just supposed to know it by osmosis.
Yeah, I don't know. You're just supposed to just wander life without knowing things.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. The beauties of what I've learned is that, you know what, like I said before, you just got to do you and you don't worry about that stuff. That's baggage that can hold you back as opposed to helping you move forward.
For sure. So but I have, you know, as you know, we ask our guests for a question about, you know, ember blazing, and it's the theme of our podcast. And so one of the things that struck us was a comment in your LinkedIn profile that you say, I'm committed to the principle that having lawyers of all backgrounds greatly enriches Sidley's perspective of the legal landscape and enhances its ability to serve its clients. And we'd love to learn more about, you know, the statement itself and what this means to you and how it connects to, you know, the ember in you.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I literally can talk for the next hour about this. So prepare yourself, brace yourself.
All right, we're ready. We're ready.
Okay.
So to try to keep it simple, I think what I would say is, it really is, I think, most important in the day in which we live today, right? The whole reason why we talk about diversity to begin with, right? If you go back 20, 30, 40 years, when you had people like Sandra Day O'Connor coming out of law school, top of her class and not able to get a job as a lawyer, or Ruth Bader Ginsburg coming out of law school, top of her class and not able to get, the whole reason why we have diversity in the profession and initiatives and goals and efforts, et cetera, is to bring more perspectives to the table, because it has been confirmed. You know, you have empirical evidence, you have anecdotal evidence to show that if you have folks around the table with different perspectives, you are more likely to have success in your whatever business, legal profession, your social networks. The more you have people of diverse backgrounds around you, different perspectives, different ideas, the better and able you are to serve your constituents, the better able you are to serve your clients, the better able you are to motivate people.
Yep.
And the better able you are to bring people together, right?
Yeah.
And as an institution, if that is our goal, right, to be successful, to sell more widgets, to sell more legal services, to have a workplace environment where people feel like they belong and they're valued, then what better than to have efforts and initiatives to enhance and support people of diverse backgrounds, right? And I think that's so important to me.
And I think that's really a key point, especially in the global world that we live in. Not that we haven't been in a global world, but we're, you know, every day very interconnected, and having that kind of human understanding of why it's important to get to know each other, understand different viewpoints is critical to the success as you know, on an individual and a corporate or institutional level.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of times people that are anti-DEI, and again, sadly, there's a lot of that happening in the world right now, and certainly in our country, they think about it as a zero-sum game, right? It's like somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. Well, no, that's not what diversity is about, right? That's not what inclusion is about. It's the opposite. It's bringing people together. It's enhancing everything around you. And why would you not want that? And I've been thinking about that a lot lately also, because you see a lot of state legislatures around the country are defunding, you know, DEI initiatives at public universities. And that is so, so, so sad, right? Just think about the message that sends to women and people of diverse backgrounds around the country. You're not wanted here, because that's how I interpreted those efforts, right? We don't want more people like you in and around our institutions, because if we did, we wouldn't be doing this, you know, defunding nonsense. But anyway, that's a topic for another day, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote something recently on echo chambers, because it was just a thing that was in the top of my head. Because it does, what it becomes is this echo chamber where you're just hearing people like you, right? It's like listening to yourself. And that's lovely if you want someone to walk around saying, you're beautiful, you're wonderful, you're just doing that back and forth. But sometimes you have to call your baby ugly. And sometimes people have to feel comfortable saying, your baby's ugly and here's why. And if you're stuck in this echo chamber where the only voices that are heard are the ones that are saying, oh, it's beautiful, beautiful, you got it, you got it. And the person who wants to be like, hi, me, I something's wrong. You eventually either stop sharing or you walk away. And that happens, right?
And it leads to a lot of misunderstanding too, right? Because again, one of the things that I found over the course of my career is that oftentimes when people are not engaged, the reason they're not engaged is because they didn't have the right information, right? If you have an event or you have a program, you have an initiative, and it's important for so-and-so to be there, or, you know, to have this particular group of people be there, if you don't invite them, you can't assume that they're just going to show up, right?
Right.
You would like them to, because, you know, they should know that it's important for them to be there. But that doesn't always happen. And you have to, you know, be thoughtful about the way in which you engage with your colleagues and the people that, you know, you have identified as important to advancing whatever it is that you're trying to advance.
So I'm going to ask you a little bit, and I know you've started touching on it. I know that while you were at Sidley, before you became the chief diversity officer, you spent many years, right, on the diversity committee and was instrumental in kind of designing and developing some of the diversity initiatives that Sidley Current has. And then they asked you to become the chief diversity officer. Can you talk a little bit about some of your philosophies? Like, what were some of the things that you employed while you were on the diversity committee as ways to make a difference for Sidley?
Yeah, I think, when the firm, as mentioned before, the firm merged, Sidley and Austin merged with Brown & Wood in 2001. And one of the things that the new firm did, which I think at the time was unique, was they established what was then called the Diversity and Racial the Committee on Racial and Ethnic Diversity, and then a separate committee, the Committee on the Retention and Promotion of Women. Those are two committees that were launched at a national level or global level, I should say. And then also each office had, or most of our offices had a local diversity committee and a local Committee on Retention and Promotion of Women. And so in 2002, when the New York version of the diversity committee was established, I was by then a partner, and I was asked to chair that committee. And all of the chairs, my counterparts across the firm, we didn't have the infrastructure that exists today. So we were really building the firm's D&I initiatives and programs from scratch at that point.
Wow.
And so it took us a long time. We all the programs that we have in place, the major ones, basically grew in that time period, 2002 to roughly 2010, 2011 or so. So our mentoring program, our recruiting programs, our promotion programs, those are all things that grew in that time. And as the chair of the New York office, I was very, very engaged and involved and among the leaders of the cohorts of the local office chairs, because it was something that was so important to me. And why was it important to me? In 2003, our beloved Puerto Rican Bar Association in New York called me and said, we want to recognize and give you the Puerto Rican Bar Association award, achievement award. And it was my first professional award. And I was so excited. I was so excited. 2003. I remember who I was talking to. I remember I got the phone call. I received the message. I was so happy. I hung up the phone and I immediately called my husband. I said, Jim, I'm getting this award. And then the Puerto Rican Bar Association, near and dear to my heart. Love it. And then he says to me, well, what are they giving it to you for? And I was like, good question. I'll come back to you. And so I dialed back, right? Back to that we had, I think we still had rotary dials back then. And I called and I said, you know, hey, I just got this phone call. I'm so excited. You know, why am I getting this award? And the person says, oh, Maria, you know, you're great. I was like, yeah, I know that, right? I know that. But why am I getting this award?
Yeah.
And what I was told at the time was that I was in New York City, 2003, one of a handful of Latina partners and major law firms.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew my mind.
Not
it
surprised.
Absolutely blew my mind. And I said, this can't be. And I said, thank you very much. I look forward to the ceremony, et cetera. And I hung up the phone and I started talking to some folks at the firm. Hey, could this possibly be true? And we sat there and we literally counted, you know, in one or two hands, less than one or two hands, how many Latina partners there were in the city at the time. And from that point forward, I was on a mission. I was on a mission to raise awareness. I was on a mission to encourage and motivate other Latinas to pursue their careers, to not be afraid of the absence of, you know, representation at partnership levels across the firm. Because what I found, and I think this is generally true, firms, big law firms in New York, they want to have more diversity in the partnership ranks. And if you pursue your career with, you know, intent and guidance and the support of the right people, you can do it. You can do it and you can be very successful. So that became my goal, is to really focus on trying to open doors for others so that I, you know, wouldn't be the only one.
It sounds like a blazing ember. It sounds like a fuego.
I was just surprised. I just couldn't believe it, you know, and you know, to some extent it was my naivete. To some extent it was just, I didn't want to believe it, but it was true.
I love that you kind of set the stage of what this was like, right? Because sometimes it's we can take for granted the fact that D&I has become a more present conversation, right? It has obviously many troubles still, but I think, you know, in the early 2000s, it wasn't front and center. And I'd love to hear from you, you know, what it was like to start talking about those issues as you were like realizing this, right? The level of education and thoughtfulness that has to go into it so that as you're driving a mission forward, you're not offending people. You're not alienating people. You're kind of also justifying the need, because at that point, I don't even know if the studies that, for example, we turn to today to say, you know, not only is it like a kind of this, you know, very good, there's very good social reasons to do it, but then there's a business case, right? Because ultimately sometimes for corporations, you need to make the business case, right? What was it like at that time for people who weren't around in this environment? What was it like to start embarking on these efforts?
Yeah, as an associate, I remember in the mid 90s, and I want to say 96, but I could be off a year or two. The firm asked me to attend a conference that was being hosted by the then general counsel of MetLife. I think, you know, TIA Cref was there. There were a couple other major financial institutions that were convening a meeting of managing partners and other leaders at law firms, right? And so the managing partner at my firm at the time invited me to go and be there with him. And I remember distinctly the general counsel of MetLife at the time, his name was James Lipscomb. And, you know, it was a full day of meetings and presentations and discussions around the absence of lawyers of diverse backgrounds. And at the time, the focus was really on racial and ethnic background, the lack of representation amongst law firms and the corporations that they serve. Mm-hmm. And the mission statement at the time was, we need to do something about this, right? And there was another around the same time, later in the 90s, an effort by the general counsel of General Mills. It was a famous call to action that was, and I'm blanking on the gentleman's name, and I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. But there were efforts among the general counsels of color at major institutions to raise awareness about the lack of representation of minorities in the legal profession. And James Lipscomb, I remember him saying at the time, the quote, law firms that don't get it are dying, they just don't know it yet.
Wow.
And at the time, I was a mid-level senior associate, and I didn't really understand what that meant. And I just tucked it away in my brain. So fast forward a few years later, when I'm now the chair of the New York Diversity Committee, that statement fueled me. And I shared it with all the, you know, my colleagues, because to me, it was a wake-up call, right? To me, it was like, hey, guys, we got to do something. Not only, as you said, Diana, it's the right thing to do from a moral and social point of view, but it's also a business imperative.
Yes.
We got to do this. We have to, you know, change the way we think about talent. Because at the end of the day, what we're talking about is the talent. Law firms don't care if you're blue, purple, green, brown, right? They want talent. And historically, the way that talent has been identified is, oh, talent, you go to find talent at, you know, these 5 schools, these 10 schools, these 20 schools. You go find talent at, you know, these corporations. You go find talent in a very narrow bucket, right? Yeah. And so what we were trying to do, you know, in the diversity space, those of us who were working in that space at the time was like, hey, wait a minute. Let's open the lens. There's talent exists in many other places, right? Let's not be so narrow-minded about where we identify talent and what talent looks like, right? Because talent is not just, you know, a white heterosexual male from, you know, top of the class at Harvard, right? Not that there's anything wrong with that. Great talent. But you know what? There's great talent at other schools, right? There's great talent at Southern University. There's great talent at, you know, HBCU law schools. There's great talent at so-called second-tier law schools as well. If you're looking for, you know, the best, they exist in these other places for various different reasons. It's not, you know,
right.
It doesn't matter whether the talent.
100%. Yeah.
So as we're building the infrastructure, we were trying to be very mindful of, you know, let's go look outside of the normal circle to find that talent that we think is going to help us deliver the best legal services possible. And so we grew from there. And, you know, we, as I said, I'd like to think at least we were very successful in some areas and identified areas where we can improve. And we still, you know, continue to do that to today.
I love that you kind of emphasize so much how important it is, right? Not only to educate ourselves, but to share that education. Because in advocacy, sometimes you lose sight of that a little bit, right? But you need to really be well-versed on the statistics, on the issues, to be able to change the mindset of those around us, right? So it is a very key aspect of the whole effort.
Yeah, I found particularly when you're trying to change an environment where, and lawyers, you know, specifically, I think the lawyers, they need proof. You know, show me the evidence.
Right.
Show me the research that supports these propositions. Right. So yeah, you need to be armed with that information. You need to be able to share. And you know, one of the things, maybe we'll talk about this later as well, but I practiced law for almost 30 years before I became the firm's chief diversity officer. And I took that moment in my career, you know, very seriously, because what I was doing at the time, and you know, maybe some people won't fully appreciate what this means, but I gave up being a partner at one of the top, at the time, 6 or 7 law firms in the world.
And you were kicking butt, by the
way.
My
partnership.
You were kicking butt. You were kicking butt, right?
I was.
Own it.
You were a very respected litigator, right?
Yes.
Who worked on some really, they were not simple litigations, right? And you were able to navigate those. And so, yeah. You were.
Yeah, no, I had a tremendous career as a litigator. I loved the clients that I worked with. I had some crazy, crazy cases over the course of my litigation career. But as I became more senior, and as I continued to look at the numbers, and I continue to see that notwithstanding all of this effort, you know, not just us, I mean, across the profession, across Fortune 500, corporate America, the statistics continue to show essentially a flat line on the racial and ethnic diversity progress, right? Yeah. We did much, much better on the gender side, but we were not having impact, at least, you know, material sustained meaningful impact on the racial and ethnic side, at least not to our satisfaction. So when I did consider the transition to chief diversity officer, I spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, what can we do different? I'm not going to come into this role and just continue to do what we've been doing, because, you know, that has been successful to some extent, but, you know, there's much, much more that we need to be done. So one of the things that I did is I thought long and hard and came to what I refer to as my three pillars to approach diversity at the firm and beyond.
Yes, which we will talk about in part two, because we
have too much to cover.
Spends. So I just want to thank you so much for the time you've spent with us today. And so we're going to come back, folks, and you are going to want to come back, because we're going to talk a bit about your three pillars. And then I also want to talk about, because look, this woman was a litigator. She was doing diversity stuff. She had 2 children. She had a husband, which sometimes counts as 3 children. But anyway,
and I'll tell you that.
You have a really nice husband. He's good. He's good. He's very self-reliant. But in other relationships, you know, sometimes. But the other piece that we will share with everyone when we come back is just the extensive nonprofit pro bono work that you did on top of everything else. So it wasn't just helping the industry, it was helping the community. And so we will come back with that. And so thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, ladies. Thank you so much. I look forward to continuing our conversation.
Thank you. So everyone, please listen where you find our podcast. Thank you.
Hasta luego.
Thanks for tuning in to the Blazing Ember podcast and our journey to empowerment. Look out for more episodes to keep your ember blazing.
Visit blazingember.com, where you can connect with us and share your feedback. Hasta pronto.